This is a Voice of the Shuswap exclusive presentation. Corin Raymond, musician and storyteller at the PACT Salmon Arm Public Art Gallery, April 1st, 2012. The live audience was enthralled by Corin's imaginative and impassioned tale of one of his life's journeys. Listen while his masterful style gives form to this story.
First of all, it was October, a rare month for boys. Not that all months aren't rare, but there'd be bad and good, as the pirates say. This is a story about a father who read to his son. It's about Ray Bradbury, the most incredible moment of synchronicity that I've ever experienced in my life. Spider-Man, growing up in a library, and the Twilight Zone. But before I get to any of that stuff, I gotta tell you how I met the Minotaur for the first time, just outside Wawa, Ontario. Now, my dad told me Greek myths on long car trips. He was a high school history teacher, and ancient Greece was one of his passions. Now, we lived up in Cochenour, Ontario until I was 7 years old. Now, Cochenour, Ontario, just to put in perspective, it's a 30-hour drive northwest of Toronto. Now, I don't know how it is in BC, but in Ontario, people talk all kinds of different things about what Northern Ontario is, but I'd like to clear this up right now before we even begin. For instance, I was at a music festival last summer in Sudbury, right? It's just a 4-hour drive north of Toronto, and someone said, "How do you like Northern Ontario?" Let's just get this out of the way. Sudbury is not Northern Ontario. I can get to Sudbury without stopping to pee. Personal geographical theory for you. If you can get there from Toronto without stopping to pee, you are not in Northern Ontario. Cochenour is where the red lines end on the Ontario map. There is actually no Ontario pavement after Cochenour. Now, my grandparents, they lived in Ottawa when I was a kid. And if you know Ontario, Ottawa is in the exact far southeastern corner of Ontario. So anytime we visited my grandparents, my dad and I spent 2 solid days in the car together. Later we moved to southern Ontario down to Georgetown, and we would take the same road back up north to visit my dad's sister and her family in Dryden, which is almost exactly as far north as Cochenour. Now, I don't know if anyone here has ever done that road through northern Ontario. If you have, you know, first of all, you know how gorgeous it is. Yeah. But for the sake of my story, you know how much of it there is. Like, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles. Spruce, pine, rocks, and water. Gas stations selling minnows and leeches. And smoked fish. We'd also stop in Thunder Bay to stay with my stepmother Karen's family. So my dad and I spent a lot of time in the car together when I was a kid. And I don't care what you say, man, there's only so many things you can draw with an Etch-a-Sketch. So to pass the hours on the road, my dad would tell me stories of the Greek gods and heroes. And that was the first time I ever heard about Ulysses or the Trojan horse or the Cyclops. And my dad would bring these stories to life for me with simple details. Like when he told me the story of Ulysses and the Cyclops, for instance, he said that when Ulysses and his men landed on the Cyclops Island, they didn't know it was the Cyclops Island, you know, when they landed on the island, so they were so hungry that when they smelled the meat roasting in the empty cave, not knowing it was the Cyclops cave, but he said they were so hungry they fell on the spit. He told me that they tore the meat from the spit with their bare hands, even though it burned their flesh, even though it burned their mouths to eat it. He also, he told me a lot of stories about Ulysses. He also told me about the Trojan horse and the sacking of Troy, and how the Greeks used the Trojans' pride against them by offering them this magnificent gift, the great wooden horse, which was then wheeled into the city of Troy, and how Ulysses and his men stayed hidden inside it until after nightfall. But my absolute favorite, the one that I could never hear enough, was of Theseus and the Minotaur. Now, first thing about Theseus, he never knew who his father was. He grew up in Troezen with his mother. He never knew that his father was the king of Athens, King Aegeus. In fact, his mother's a secret lover of Aegeus. When Theseus is born, Aegeus hides a pair of sandals and a beautiful sword under a huge stone. And he tells her that when her son is strong enough to move the stone and claim the gifts under it, that he's to come to Athens and reveal himself, right? So she takes Theseus to the stone when he's still a boy. And every year he tries to move it. And every year he fails until finally, one year he's strong enough and he turns the stone over and he finds out who he really is. Now Theseus decides right then that instead of taking the safe road to Athens, instead of taking the tourist route along the sea, that he'll take the hard road inland and meet all the murderers and monsters that have been plaguing the countryside and make a name for himself on the way, just like Hercules did with his 12 tasks. So by the time Theseus arrives in Athens, he is already a hero. And I love this part. I love when Theseus gets to Athens and, you know, he's never met his father, the king, before. King Aegeus is like hugging him and crying. Parenting's a little easier in ancient Greece, is what I say. You know? All you really needed was a really big stone. You were set. So Theseus and his father are reunited and everything's beautiful. But when the springtime comes, a darkness just falls over the people of Athens. And I mean, Theseus can't help but notice. He says, what's the matter? What's wrong? What's wrong with everyone? And his father won't say anything. He just says, some tragedies are hard enough to bear without having to speak of them. But Theseus will not leave him alone. And finally, he learns that every spring, a ship with black sails comes from Crete to collect a tribute from Athens of 7 young women and 7 young men who are then taken back to Crete and fed one by one to the Minotaur, the creature that lives in the labyrinth under the palace of King Minos. Every spring, there's a lottery to choose who will be taken. And when Theseus hears this, he says, I'll be one of the 14. They won't have to draw a lot for me. I'll go to Crete, and I will kill the Minotaur, and I will end this. And when his father hears this, he's horrified. And he begs him. He literally begs him not to. He can't imagine there's any hope he will ever return. And when he sees that there's nothing he can say to stop Theseus, he says, okay, if you're going to go, then you go. But make me one promise. The ship that's taking you has black sails. But if you survive, if you live, if you do succeed, hoist a white sail so that I'll know. So I won't have to watch, you know, waiting, wondering for days whether you're alive or dead. And Theseus promises to hoist a white sail. And Theseus does succeed. He kills the Minotaur. That's a whole other story. With the help of Ariadne. Ariadne is the daughter of King Minos. She's the one who gives him the ball of thread, tells him to tie it to a stone when he enters the labyrinth and to never let it go, which is how he finds his way back after killing the monster. But in all the excitement of his triumph, you know, and his adventures and his success, Theseus completely forgets his promise to hoist a white sail. And Aegeus watches every day from the cliffs, and when he sees those black sails on the horizon, he's so heartbroken that he throws himself to his death. Which is why they call it the Aegean Sea to this very day. And Theseus comes home to find that his father has killed himself because of the promise that he forgot to keep. And I cried every time my dad told me that story, because it was so huge and unfair. And I wanted to hear it again. And again. And again. I grew up in a library. It wasn't a public library. I didn't have to like hide from the cleaners at night and stuff like that. That would have been cool, though. That would have been like a good 80s movie. I grew up in my dad's library. Now, I don't know exactly how many books there are in my dad's house, and I don't think he knows either. It might be 10,000, and maybe less. for the sake of my story, let's just say there is no need for wallpaper in any of my dad's rooms. In fact, let's just say, you want to read about Russia? Oh, you're in luck. So there's a wall of my dad's den is devoted to Russia. You want ancient Greece, Rome, mythology, religion? It's the wall across from Russia. World War II, Germany, Japan, Britain? It's a wall downstairs. Books about movies, a wall in the basement. Fiction snakes around two floors of my dad's house. Shelved alphabetically, unless it pertains to American history, in which case it's got its own stack opposite American history itself. Same goes for Britain. Africa, top shelf. Some authors get special treatment in my dad's house. Winston Churchill, for instance, he's got a cabinet display under glass. So does Rex Stout. Shakespeare has an entire cabinet all to himself. Canadian history has its own room. That's my dad's bedroom. He's got his bed, his sock drawers, and his own private stacks, complete with their own aisle. Sherlock Holmes has half a wall in my dad's house. Pastiches of Sherlock Holmes stories have I don't know if anyone here ever whoop, like you wake up in the middle of the night, cold sweat, nothing on your mind but like pastiches of Sherlock Holmes stories. You know? I'm here in my dad's house, that's your lucky night. Humor and poetry are in the guest room. It's a library. My father is its librarian. Now, if I came home from high school, for instance, and I said, hey, Dad, I got to do this project in history class on Heinrich Schliemann. Do you have anything on Heinrich Schliemann? Who, by the way, he was the dude who proved to the world that Troy was not a mythological place. It was a real city. He was one of the only people in the world who believed it existed. He was obsessed his entire life with finding and uncovering the real city of Troy, and he did it. And if I said, you got anything on Heinrich? So my dad would start ducking around the house, and soon there'd be a little tower on the table, you know? And he'd say, well, let's see here. I have 8 or 9 books about Schliemann. Two of them novels, one by Peter Ackroyd. For a brief overview of his life, I recommend beginning with chapter 4 of this one. It's an excellent overview. This is a fantastic mini-series, which I enjoyed very much when it aired and made sure that I taped, called In Search of the Trojan War. The first episode is much about Schliemann. This box, you'll be interested to know, contains a radio play for high school students with John Vernon as Schliemann, which I wrote to the CBC about when I was teaching up in Sioux Lookout. They very kindly sent me this reel-to-reel tape of the program. I can't play it, but I keep it tucked on the shelf amongst my books on the subject. Meet my dad. The only problem with this program is that I would forget all about the schoolwork part, right? I'd be watching the miniseries, like reading the fiction, essays, articles from my dad's father. Like once I was hooked on Schliemann, I was gone. Like, you know, I would go deeper into his life than my teachers ever dreamed I would. I'd become like the school Schliemann expert. Telling anyone about him who would listen. And there is no time in this show to talk about what a fascinating dude Heinrich Schliemann was or how crazy his life was. You should look him up. But I mean, what was the point? What was the point of doing schoolwork now? Along similar lines, I once got kicked out of English class for reading a book. It was the wrong book. It was the wrong book. I had to read it out in the hall.
It's all true.
I'm going to introduce myself a little further to you by saying, by telling you this. My mother died when I was born. And actually, she died before I was born. They were keeping her alive on machines. She contracted tubercular meningitis halfway through her pregnancy with me, and she would have died long before she came to term if she hadn't wanted to have me as much as she did, and she fought to get me here. She died in the Health and Sciences Center in Winnipeg, Manitoba. Now, my dad remarried when I was 2 years old to a teacher he met at the Red Lake High School where he was teaching history. Her name was Karen. She died when I was 6. She had cancer. She had a tumor. She had a brain tumor. She actually died in the same hospital where I was born. In fact, it was the same doctor who came out and told my dad. And he came out and he said, Mr. Raymond, I didn't believe them when they told me it was the same man. So when we moved to Southern Ontario, to Georgetown, and we were running from bad memories. And my dad got a teaching job, but when he transferred from Northern Ontario, he lost all his seniority. He had to start all over again, and all the joy went out of his work. And for me, there was a sadness that just permeated our house in those years. And Sunday nights, they were the saddest of all, right? Because the safety of the weekend was gone. There was nothing left between me and Monday morning. And when I was a kid, Monday morning meant going to school. It meant being bullied. It meant not fitting. It meant classes I hated, math questions I dreaded being called up to do in front of the class. Monday was the real world. That was the world of grown-ups. That was the world my dad faced every morning at 6 a.m. when he got up and made us porridge and toast before going off to a job that wore him out. And it was a world I knew I would have to face myself someday. On Sunday nights, I could feel it coming. The bureaucracies, the obligations, the bosses, the infighting, the exhaustion of it all. Like, how did grown-ups even do it? That was a world I knew I would never be able to navigate. I used to lie awake when I was a kid in bed on Sunday nights. I used to just lie there dreading growing up. But luckily, there is a fifth dimension beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition. And it lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area which we call the Twilight Zone. Check it out. That's right. That was great. We can use that. That's what happened at the beginning. Every Sunday afternoon from 4 to 5 p.m., CDTV show reruns of the Twilight Zone back to back. Right? Just before dinner, before Sunday night could take control. There was this oasis, this escape, this black and white island, this escape to another world, right? Now, that world was scary, too. But it was not scary the way Sunday nights were scary, or Monday mornings. The Twilight Zone was scary like the Greek myths in the car. It was disturbing, cathartic, and wondrous. Now, there's an episode I remember in particular. It was called Time Enough at Last. Burgess Meredith plays Henry Bemis. He's a bank teller, and he's a bookworm, like the original bookworm. He's got like Coke bottle eyeglasses, and his hair is like busted couch stuffing. And Henry's passion for everything printed is treated with contempt by his wife and by his boss and even by the customers at the bank. And all Henry wants, his only wish, is to have the time and the solitude to read. So Henry takes his afternoon lunch breaks in the basement bank vault to read in peace and quiet. And one afternoon, while he is down in the safe, the atomic bomb drops, and the whole world ends. And Henry climbs out to find there is nothing left but rubble and debris as far as he can see. He clambers around the wreckage looking for one other survivor. But there's no one. He is totally alone. He finds a revolver in what had been a sporting goods store, and he sits down in the rubble to take his own life. And it is just as he is about to pull the trigger on himself that he sees the words "public library" on a fallen pillar. Henry adjusts his Coke bottle glasses, and the camera shows books. Books of all shapes and sizes spilling down the library steps. And Henry scrambles over the broken stone, snatching them up in his hands. You know, the collected works of Charles Dickens, the collected works of George Bernard Shaw, poems by Shelley, Browning, and Keats. And he clutches them like loved ones. He makes a little tower on each step for each month of reading he now has ahead of him. You know, January, February, March, April, this year, and the next year. And the best thing is, he says, the best thing is there's time now. Time enough at last. Henry reaches for his first book, and his glasses slip from his face and they break on the stone steps. The camera shows the world gone blurry. Henry comes up, the last cracked bits of the lenses crumbling through his fingers. And the camera pans away and leaves Henry Bemis weeping on the library steps with all the books he loves out of reach forever. I cried when I first saw that episode. It was so huge and unfair. And I wanted to see it again. And again. And again. And listen, I really appreciate you folks being here tonight. I just want you to know that this show is not, it's not just going to be a succession of depressing stories. I promise you. Stay with me. First of all, it was October, a rare month for boys. Not that all months aren't rare, but there'd be bad and good, as the pirates say. Those are the first words of "Something Wicked This Way Comes" by Ray Bradbury. Now, I know those words like I know the opening lines of my favorite songs. When I was a kid, I probably read Ray Bradbury more than any other author. Like, I read Dandelion Wine every summer. I read Something Wicked This Way Comes every fall. I read them until I could practically recite them. And I was always, I'd buy any used copies of any Ray Bradbury books that I saw anywhere. I'd just buy them and give them away. You know, Fahrenheit 451, The Illustrated Man, The Martian Chronicles. And I was always giving away my last copy of a Ray Bradbury book. I go, like, looking through my own library for my copy of Something Wicked This Way Comes. And I remember that, you know, I gave my only copy away to somebody who dropped by the house. I used to lie awake on those Sunday nights when I was, like, around 12 years old. I used to lie awake on those Sunday nights I told you about, just worrying that Ray Bradbury might die before I had the chance to tell him what he meant to me. And actually, when I was around 12 years old, I wrote him a letter to tell him so. And I sent it to his publisher, but I never heard back. Ray Bradbury hit me in my Twilight Zone years, right around the same time as Stephen King. It was my dad who introduced me to Stephen King. And I got to tell you, my dad had this incredible ability to say one thing about a book or a writer. He wouldn't even know he was doing it. He'd just say one thing, and it would be enough. I would then go off privately, discover that thing for myself. And in this case, he told me that he was reading Salem's Lot, which is Stephen King's vampire story. He said he was reading it up in Kochner in the wintertime with the power out. Don't read Salem's Lot with the power out, by the way. He was reading it by candlelight. And when he got to the part where the children, who are now vampires, come scratching at the window, asking to be let in, he told me that he'd been almost unable to walk down the hall to his bedroom. Now, okay, correct me if I'm wrong here. You're a 13-year-old boy, and your dad tells you about a book that made him too scared to go to his own bed. You gonna check that shit out? I got everything by Stephen King I could get my hands on. I was obsessed with him. He was a hero to me. And I mean, he was also one of those dudes posing with the cigarette and the typewriter on the back of the dust jacket. When I was 13 years old, it didn't get any more badass than that. I wanted to know, I want to be one of those guys. And the amazing thing that Stephen King did for me, in my opinion, I mean, besides telling all those incredible stories, was he got so many people reading who probably never would have read otherwise. And a lot of us Stephen King fans went on to discover all kinds of stuff. Stuff that inspired him. And Ray Bradbury was definitely one of his biggest inspirations. But I think I might have read too many other books. Because I just cannot read Stephen King anymore. And I mean, I love him still. I'm a fan for life. I just can't read him again. Ray Bradbury, on the other hand, like, I mean, I'm reading him again right now. In fact, I got in a conversation about books, and I mentioned a book I was rereading at the time. And this guy I was talking to said, like, what, you mean, so you mean the same book? I don't get it. Why would you do that? Why would you read it again if you already read it? Well, why would you listen to a song twice? I mean, why would you listen to an album again? I mean, why would you order the same food at your favorite restaurant, you know? If you meet someone you like, why get their number? I mean, why would you even talk to your buddy over there again? I mean, you met him, right? I mean, people go back to their favorite food and movies and music and their friends, their best friends. But people don't often think about books like that. With books, it's like read it, been there, done that. Now, I'm the exact opposite. Like, why would you even introduce me to this book if I can't read it? We might as well just not meet if I can't read it again. And this strikes me as grown-up thinking. Because I don't know about you, but I've never seen a kid that didn't want to hear their favorite story again. Mm-hmm. Now, when I was a kid, when I was in Red Lake with my dad, we were coaching there, we'd go to the Red Lake Public Library every Saturday. We'd stock up on our books for the week. And I would always grab my favorite books. Like, there's books I probably took out 100 times. And another thing my dad would do to prepare for those long car trips I was telling you about, check this out. He was a hard dad to have, but there were some bonuses with this guy. He would go to the library before we left. He would take out a bunch of my favorite books, and he'd wrap them in newspaper like Christmas gifts. He'd stash them in a briefcase behind the driver's seat, and he'd say, you know, when we're an hour the other side of Wawa, you remind me. I've got something for you. By the way, I just want you to know, my dad didn't drive with his hands in his pockets. I want you to know that. This is part of the shit. And I'd be like, Dad, like, you know, we left Wawa an hour ago. Like, you said you had something for me. Oh, did I say that? And he'd pull out a book wrapped like a present with my name on the wrapping. And he'd give it to me, and I'd tear it open and rediscover it. But for some reason, when we get older, that changes. And I've noticed with books, it's often like a numbers game. You know, how many books have you read? Have you read the 50 most important books of all time? It's like when people come over to my house for the first time. I live in the Kensington Market in Toronto. I live in the main floor of a house there. I don't know how many books I have. Maybe it's 1,000 books, maybe less. I don't know, but I live in a small space. And they're everywhere. And when you come into my house, you kind of have to say something about the books. Because it's what there is. There's a piano and there's books. So the crazy thing is, over the years, I've noticed that people come in, usually what they say, I don't think they even mean to say it, it just comes out of their mouths. People walk in my house and they're like, have you read all these? That's the first thing they say. How many of these have you actually read? What do I even go with that? Like, what am I supposed to say? What if I said 367? They'd be like, cool, let's go. Like, what is that even? I don't even get it. But they never ask the questions that I could answer. You know, no one ever says, which of these are your best friends? You know, are any of these the 25th copy you bought of the same book? Because you love it so much you gave them all away? Have you ever read one of these out loud on the phone? Girl you're in love with? Are there poems here that have helped you get through things? You ever stayed up all night reading one of these and then suffered an exalted loneliness because the book just reminded you how alive you are and you wish you could share that with somebody? Those would be some pretty good questions. I got answers for those. But no, have you read all these? One guy came in my house, he's looking at my books, and he's like, man, do you have all this poetry to help you score with girls? And I'm like, no, man, no, I have I have all this poetry so I can have these incredible conversations with guys like you. I'm going to put this out there. A good book has a soul. And the characters inside it have souls. Now, I happen to have read All the Pretty Horses by Cormac McCarthy. I've read it 7 or 8 times now. I've lost track. I've read that book 3 times in its entirety out loud to 3 different people. And the reason I mention it is that John Grady Cole, he's the main character of All the Pretty Horses. He's 16 years old. He's the last in a long line of Texan cattle ranchers. And when John Grady's grandfather dies and the ranch is sold, John Grady and his friend Lacey Rollins, they get on their horses and they leave for Mexico without telling anybody. And the story is about what happens to them there. But John Grady Cole, he is as real to me as anyone in my actual life. I think about him. I think about what he might do in a given situation. He is someone I have traveled with and been inspired by. And I'll be taking that trip across the border into Mexico with John Grady and Lacey Rollins just as long as I can read.